Okay, I think we're ready. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Ross Richardson, and I represent Appellant Parks in this matter. Seated with me at counsel table is Scott Gazelle, and he represents Appellant Blackwell. Before I get started, Chief Judge Traxler, I asked about this at check-in, and they asked me to ask you. We want to address the Court about the juror issues in this case. With the new policy about online arguments, we know that jurors' names are supposed to be, if they're sealed, they shouldn't be mentioned. I just wanted to ask you, these are not sealed. It's a matter of public record, but how would you like us to proceed? Do you want us to say, instead of a name, maybe Juror J or Juror W, or how would you like us to proceed?
We're familiar with their names. I think if you just
the first juror.
Any way you're comfortable doing it.
Okay.
Try to avoid their names.
Okay.
We know different things were said to different jurors. We know what was allegedly said to whom.
Okay.
And if you'd like, you can refer to us as Judge X, Y, and Z.
I'll be lawyer A.
Okay.
Okay.
You hope to make an A, or you be lawyer A?
I'm moving for an A plus. Okay, thank you. Trial by an impartial jury, of course, is one of the bedrock constitutional principles in our criminal law. In fact, the Supreme Court has called it the touchstone of a fair trial. The appellants here were not tried by an impartial jury. They were tried by a jury tainted with threats and intimidation. Several of the jurors were directly threatened or intimidated, and certainly all of the jury knew about it, was discussing it, and was aware of what was going on and the effect it had on other jurors. They were also tried by a juror who has admitted to the district court that he knew who these defendants were. He knew they were drug dealers. He'd seen them in state court before. There's evidence that he'd even sort of concocted a story about how they'd gotten off of earlier charges and were laughing at trials in this case for which the juror was serving.
What do you think the rule is if a juror is threatened? That threat alone is enough to make that juror be removed from the jury panel?
I think what the cases tell us to do is that the court needs to.
I'm just asking you that. If a person is threatened, if a juror is threatened, must that person automatically be taken off the jury panel, off the jury?
If you mean threatened in the way they were in this case?
Yeah.
I certainly would.
I'm asking, must they be?
Unless they, through thorough voir dire, can indicate that they can be fair and impartial, I think in an abundance of caution, at least Juror J should have been struck.
Why did that not incent the very type of behavior? If a juror if a juror is to be, out of an abundance of caution, excused if the juror is threatened, why does that not incent a defendant to employ that very tactic to control the composition of the jury?
Well, there's no evidence. There's no connection here.
That wasn't the question.
Right. Okay.
The question is.
Well,
it seems to be providing a fairly perverse incentive, or would provide a fairly perverse incentive.
I understand what you're saying, Judge Duncan. I think, though, that if you did that, you're going to be subject to further criminal prosecution for doing that. So I don't, and I think the rarity of threat. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Who is going to be subject to further?
If a defendant is convicted of trying to intimidate or threaten a witness,
which would require a subsequent proceeding and some indication, for instance, of the defendant's involvement. But if there's a pattern and that happens, it does appear to provide, as I said, a rather perverse incentive that inures to the benefit of a defendant who engages in such conduct, at least potentially.
I understand what you're saying about potential there. For one thing, I think it's very rare in the case law to even have threats and intimidation. So I think that sort of lets us know that in terms of the Rimmer test and things that have been set up by the courts to deal with this, it seems to be a situation where defendants are not being incentivized.
I'll tell you what's rare is where the defendant's friends go and threaten a juror, and then the defendant claims prejudice because now they're scared.
But there's no evidence that they were defendant's friends. We don't know who these people were. There's no information in the record.
Well, they were spectators in the courtroom.
Right, but they could be anybody. And there's nothing in the record that they, you know, of who they were. In fact, the government made a big deal about bringing in the marshals and the FBI, and we're going to have this big law enforcement.
But here's the point. They were trying to influence the jury in a way that would be beneficial to the defendant.
Yeah, whether they knew him or not.
They could have been officious in the meddlers, but they certainly weren't saying, you better convict him or we'll have a raid and have the government raise your taxes. They were clearly trying to influence the jury in a way that would benefit the defendant. Isn't that correct?
I think that's correct. And although, actually, the government tries to disavow that they were actually associated with the defendants in their briefing.
But go back to that question. It seems to me this really is a case of an argument is we should give whoever did that a second chance to really be successful in intimidating the jury this time. Is that not what this case is about? Giving those who would tamper with the jury a second chance to be successful.
If someone's going to tamper with a jury, they're subject to criminal prosecution.
Have you ever been involved with somebody tampering or talking to a juror?
I have.
I have too. Was a successful prosecution brought because of it? Against the person who did the threat.
It was a SLED agent, actually. I used to practice in South Carolina.
Right.
So no, he was not. Not that we know of. He was
me
not
either.
Prosecuted.
Yeah, I've had it on. I can think of a few occasions when I was a trial judge in federal court in which witnesses were either assaulted or else they were threatened. It was maybe more than that. And nothing ever comes of it. You send an investigation, nothing ever comes of it. So that stuff about they get punished for it, I think that's more of a myth, quite frankly, than the truth. But in this case, what the judge was aware of some attempt, and the judge took of some attempt to talk to somebody and to threaten them, really, and try to influence them. And the judge took steps. What was wrong with what the judge did?
Well,
you may be wanting something else done, but why is what the judge did improper, in your opinion? Or not sufficient, I guess.
Thank you. Yes, Your Honor. The reason it's insufficient is because he never asked the jury the crucial question of whether they could be fair and impartial. Some of the jurors voir dired in chambers. He did ask them of that. Juror Jay, the juror who was most upset and crying and, in fact, too frightened to even come out of the courtroom, he did not ask her that question. The defense counsel moved to ask her to individually voir dire her, and
did he ask the entire panel after that? Asked the entire panel if they could sit on the case and decide the case on the evidence presented.
Right. What he said something along the lines of separate concern about bystanders.
Why isn't that sufficient?
Because the question that needs to be asked is whether they can be fair and impartial. And he never did that. And, in fact, he indicated
that he had to use those exact words or else it's an error.
I think he does. Because that's what you need to know. Can you be fair and impartial?
Do you have,
not can you separate a concern?
Is there any case law that says you have to ask, you have to phrase the question exactly that way, fair and impartial?
I don't know that there is case law saying you have to say those magic words. But here the problem is what he said when all was talking in the context of, here, we're providing you with all of this security, you know, which we think heightens their sense of fear. We're providing you with all the security. We're escorting you to the car and that type of thing. And now that we're taking care of you and protecting you, can you not worry about being afraid? That he's not asking them. He's not saying, can you be fair and impartial considering what has happened? Fair and impartial is the standard.
Did he ask anything about deciding the case on the evidence presented?
I think he said. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did he ask that question when he talked to the entire panel when he brought him back out?
I
can't find the record right this second, but it was my recollection that he asked, could they sit on the case and decide the case on the evidence presented?
Right. After he goes through the business about, you know, you're going to be secure, he says something along those lines, and then but he doesn't ask the question. He just says that, then he says, can you separate concern? And he indicated that he would voir dire juror Jay later. The government convinced him to wait until the end of trial. And he indicated that he would voir dire her at the end of trial and then never did that. So I think whatever sort of – I understand the court's concern about whether people can be incentivized to have this conduct or do this conduct in the future. But the reality is the cases do not consider that as a factor. When you look at the Cheek and the Rimmer test, we've certainly satisfied that. The test is whether a party shows that there were extrajudicial communications that were more than innocuous, and that's not in dispute here. Here, the government's burden was to show there's no reasonable probability that the jury's verdict was influenced by an improper communication. It's undisputed that the Rimmer presumption has been triggered here. And the government has not met their burden to show that there's no reasonable probability that the verdict was affected. First, the government says
you should... Let me ask you this. To page 651, I did find the record, 651. It appears to me the judge says, so if I have the sequence right. So let me ask you this then, with that in mind. My question is, can all the jurors and each of you individually continue to sit and hear the case, hear the evidence, and render your verdict according to what you hear from the witness stand and the exhibits into evidence and follow the law that the court gives you? Do you believe you can all follow that instruction? And there were affirmative nods. What he's asked, can they continue to do what he tells them to do? Why hasn't he asked?
Well, they can continue to do what he tells them, but they can't continue to be fair and impartial necessarily. That question is not asked. Further, the district court did not go into the Rimmer and Cheek test, and he has to do that under the Supreme Court law and this court cases. And that test was never, he never did that. He never weighed those burdens. He never held the government to that burden. And even post-trial, he didn't hold the government to that burden. And the government can't meet that burden here. He's not even used the correct words.
I asked, are there absolute words that have to be used? Do you think there are?
I think you have to be sure that the jurors can be fair and impartial. That's what's asked at voir dire. That is the concept.
Why isn't that? You render your verdict according to what you hear from the witness stand and the exhibits and the evidence and follow the law that the court gives you. Why isn't that the same thing as saying, can you be fair and impartial? Why isn't it the same thing? If you base it on the evidence received and my instructions. In other words, that excludes any extraneous matter. Why is that not the equivalent of that?
Well,
carrying out your duties as you're supposed to.
Okay. I think that even if it were, the government has still not met their burden under Cheek. Even if that were, I'm not conceding that, Your Honor, but even if that were the case, the government still has a burden under Cheek here, which they have not met. They went through...
Burden to do what?
Pardon?
What else has to be done?
The government has got to show that there's no reasonable probability that the verdict was affected by the threats and intimidation. And Cheek's the standard. In Cheek, you have one contact one time with one juror who never tells any other juror. And Cheek doesn't talk about, well, are we incentivizing someone or is this going to encourage someone to intimidate a jury in the future? What Cheek says, this is the standard, and this is as far as you can go.
What do you think the government had to show after all of this? What do you think they had to show after the verdict?
They've got to show that the verdict was not in – the Cheek test says they have to show that the verdict was not affected by the threats and intimidation. They've got – it's a very heavy burden, as this court, Supreme Court has said. It's a heavy burden. No reasonable probability. And Cheek says – even one contact one time with one juror is a reasonable probability that the jury was affected. So if that's the standard, this case is much worse than what happened in Cheek in terms of the jury. I see that I'm out of time. I've saved some time for rebuttal. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Ms. Gazelle.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Scott Gazelle, and I am the counsel for Appellant Jermaine Blackwell. If the Court has any further questions on the issues that Ms. Richardson addressed, I'd be more than happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'm prepared to go forward with the issue regarding Juror M. Your Honors, in that particular situation, there was a juror who failed to disclose that he knew of both defendants, that he had seen them in a courtroom setting before, and that he had knowledge that they had previously been involved in drug activities. Voir dire, this particular juror did not disclose that information. in response to questions as to whether or not he knew any of the defendants involved in this case. Had he answered correctly, had he answered truthfully, that would have formed a valid basis for a challenge for cause. Certainly the defendants are entitled to a fair and impartial jury, a jury who does not know intricate details of the defendant's life or the defendant's business, a juror who comes in with a clean slate as to information pertaining to these particular individuals.
One of the problems with respect to that particular juror, though, is that there was a discrepancy between what the juror said to the post-trial investigator and what he testified to during the evidentiary hearing on the matter.
That's correct.
There was a fair amount of backtracking.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, and it appears to me that the district court credited the version given during the evidentiary hearing, which makes some sense since he's sworn.
I understand that, Your Honor, but nonetheless, there is a thread of information that he did know of these individuals and had.
Well, he knew or had heard something of defendants' reputation in the community.
And I would submit, Your Honor, that the defendant's reputation in the community was not good, and that he was aware of that, and that would necessarily have an impact on his ability to be fair and impartial.
But he was specifically questioned about that.
Correct, Your Honor. Nonetheless, had we known about that at the time we were picking the jury, that certainly would have weighed heavily on our decision as to whether or not we were going to exercise a challenge for cause with regards to this individual.
Didn't the district court specifically find that he would not have been excusable for cause?
I believe, Your Honor, the record indicates that the district judge found that the information was material, it had not been disclosed, and had that information come out, he would have granted a challenge for cause. And I think that's really key here, that the district court believed that had they known that information at the time, that juror would have been excused for cause.
I thought the judge said, after what you said.
Yeah, so did I.
I thought the record was the judge indicated he would not provide, would not have provided a basis for cause challenge. Maybe I have the record.
If I misspoke, Your Honors, then I apologize. But nonetheless,
a fairly critical point.
I understand, Your Honor. However, I would submit that the McDonough case doesn't require that the court actually would have granted the challenge for cause. It simply states, and it goes no further, that then further show that a correct response would have provided a valid basis for a challenge for cause.
Does it make any difference to your argument if the judge had said he would have stricken him for cause?
I think it makes it certainly stronger, Your Honor.
But what does it matter? I thought you said it. In the McDonough, you don't have to go on beyond that.
You don't have to, Your Honor. All you have to do is argue.
Well, the fact is that it makes it stronger. Does it make it weaker that he says he didn't think in his judgment that there was a for-cause challenge?
Does it make it weaker, Your Honor? It's simply,
as
we stand here now.
It only could help you. The judge's ruling could only help you. It could not in any way hurt you.
Correct, Your Honor, because as we sit in the trial, you have to make the determination as to whether or not it would have provided a valid basis. And there certainly is a legitimate, meritorious legal argument that this information, had it been known, we could have made a challenge for cause on that basis. It's not a situation where we would have just been, for essence, pulling something out of thin air. Had we known that information, that would have been a valid basis. What the court chooses to do with that information is not.
What's the standard that you have to make a for cause challenge? Is there any standard for that? That the judge imposes for a lawyer to make a for-cause challenge. He can rule against it or rule for it, but is there any standard imposed on when a lawyer can make that?
There would have to be some indication that the juror was biased, Your Honor.
Based on what?
The responses to the question.
No, I mean, why do you say that's the answer? Why can't a defense lawyer decide to move for cause because he just thinks in his experience or her experience that this person has displayed conduct or whatever, just his instinct. Why can't he move for a cause?
That's
right. Even if he loses or she loses the motion.
That's a peremptory challenge, Your Honor. I believe in order to make a good faith.
No, why can't he call it for cause?
You could do that, Your Honor, but the appropriate response would be.
Yeah, and that's what would be appropriate. I asked that it be done, just for cause.
Yes, the bottom line is you could make a for-cause challenge. However, as an officer of the court, you would certainly need a legal basis for it. You would not want to...
A legal basis, as you understand it, as the lawyer making the motion understand.
Correct, Your Honor, and as the court would see fit.
Do you have any authority for the proposition that a juror's general awareness of a defendant's reputation in the community is grounds for challenge for cause?
As I stand here, I don't have any authority on that, Your Honor, but I think when you look at the real-world situation, in a case such as this where we're dealing...
I was just asking about authority on...
No, I don't, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I see that I'm out of time. Thank you all.
Thank you, Ms. Gazelle. Mr. Edwards.
May it please the court. My name is Richard Edwards. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Asheville Division of the Western District of North Carolina. I was not the trial attorney. I was assigned the case on appeal.
But we take it that you're going to know it well enough to answer any questions we have about the trial. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here, would you?
If not, I've been mean to my family.
No need to tell us. Just get on with the argument.
Yes, sir. Your Honor, with regard to correcting a few things from the records, as Your Honor, Judge Shedd, correctly noted, when Judge Voorhees questioned the jurors after Juror J, the female juror, and I'll take these if the court pleases in the same order they were presented previously. When the fact of the matter was, when she was first brought into chambers, which all the parties agreed to, and she was questioned about what happened, and she talked about the threat that she received, after she left and after the other jurors were brought in, only then did Mr. Gazelle, who was the trial attorney for Mr. Blackwell, only then did he say, you know, I should have asked her as well about what could you be fair. The court said, well, I don't want to single her out by bringing her in yet again. I'll do it in court, without the defendants being present, but in court. There was no objection at that point. In fact, Mr. Gazelle sort of completed the judge's sentence about not singling her out. That's on page 645. When the judge then, Judge Voorhees, did read the instruction, or I'm sorry, question them, not only, as Your Honor just said, quoted at 651, but then he asked one more question. Can you separate any concern about bystanders, which in context he talked about the problems they'd had, and that sort of thing? Can you all do that? Affirmative nots. And then the judge said to the counsel that he would keep an eye, in essence, keep an eye on things, that we can revisit this later if it appears there's problems. And I would point out to the court at the end of the case, when there was the motion to strike this juror, among others, Judge Voorhees at that time noted after the prosecutor, and we got this wrong in our brief, saying it was the judge who said the juror seemed to have been calm throughout the trial. But when the prosecutor said that, Judge Voorhees said, and this is on page 1088, right, I haven't seen any indications that the jurors would be in a position contrary to their responses to the court when the court spoke to them about the bystander issue. So I would submit to the court that Judge Voorhees, without objection from the defense, Judge Voorhees conducted the voir dire of this juror at the time it happened, very shortly after the incident happened. And then it's clear from the record that Judge Voorhees, very experienced judge, had his sensibilities heightened, so to speak, had observed the jurors. And when the prosecutor said they appeared to have been calm, Judge Voorhees agreed and said he saw nothing to indicate to the contrary.
Let me ask you this. This case is in such an odd posture. But after the comments that were made to the jurors, a threat and then encouragement, all made on behalf of the defendant, the concern is, as I understand it, the concern is, are those jurors going to hold those threats and encouragements against the defendant? Because it's the defendant who's asserting prejudice from these favorable remarks that were made to the jurors on his behalf. I mean, isn't that really what, when you ask, can you still be fair, that what we're really asking is, are you going to hold this against the defendant, these statements?
That is true, Your Honor. And, in fact, I strove mightily to see if I couldn't find a case that said, in essence, well, you know, to the extent there was any pressure at all, it was pressure pro-defendant. If they were intimidated, you would have thought there'd be an acquittal.
This is just so odd. Normally it's the other side that...
If I could have found such a case, I would have that would have been one of the first things I was waiving. I would like to point out, however, another factual correction that I submit. this was not a series of jurors who were threatened. With regard to threats and intimidation, there was one juror, that was juror J, the female juror, juror number one, who said that she was told by the two people that if we found a conviction, we better be ready to deal with the consequences that come along with that. They know who we are. That's a 621. The other contacts, improper contacts at that Chinese restaurant were two jurors said that a person said, go easy on little Kenny, and the other was, you guys need to be fair on little Kenny, which we would all agree with. Leave him alone and go easy on him. So I don't believe, I would submit to Your Honor anyway, that's not highly threatening, just telling somebody to go easy. There's no if, he, then Q. There's no threats. There was a threat to Juror J. We concede that. Now, with regard to...
I don't know about that now. You're suggesting somebody's told go easy on little Kenny, that's not a threat?
Well, it,
well why are you saying that?
That's right. Well, I would concede...
Sort of implied.
It would not make a juror happy. I certainly concede that. I just don't want to exaggerate. It's not, if you convict Kenny, you're in a lot of trouble. We know where you live, which is a lot closer to what a juror J was told.
Do you think that, that page 651, and you heard me talk about that with other counsel, she suggests that does not meet the standard of assuring the judge that the jurors can be fair and impartial. What do you say about that?
Your Honor, to that I say...
Because you didn't say those words.
Exactly. I don't believe there's any talismanic words that are mandated. Not only that, but this court has held in U.S. v. Ford and other cases that with regard to how a district court is to address these kinds of issues, the court is given latitude and it is an abuse of discretion standard. I would also point out here that since there was no objection, it's a plain error review because at no point did the defense object to this manner of proceeding. Your Honor, also with regard to Juror J, unless the court wants to hear, there were some jurisdictional issues, but and with regard to the continued validity of the Holmes case after Smith and the Smith panel in this court in Smith, which was an ineffective assistance of counsel, pointing out it's kind of hard to see how Holmes might still be valid given that ineffective assistance of counsel isn't new evidence. It's not, of course, familiar with that. But we're not positing it entirely on this because the court's ruling post-trial, Judge Voorhees' ruling post-trial, was not premised on whether it's the 7 days versus the 3 years under Rule 33B, 1 or 2. Instead, although he did use the phrase jurisdictional, which is a catch-all, it's not jurisdictional, we know that, it's the controlled timeline. But in any event, what he found was it was not newly discovered.
Discovered evidence.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I talked too much. Thank you. I was getting there eventually. Newly discovered evidence. And the court found it was not newly discovered evidence. And in that, we submit the court was clearly correct, is entitled to deference there, and that at most, leaving aside the incompetent evidence under 606B that came in as hearsay or third party through Allard's affidavit, that's the only evidence that came in of additional so-called newly discovered. One, it wasn't evidence, and two, under Chavis, it was at most cumulative. It was to the effect that Juror J was upset. Well, that had been established, but again, Judge Voorhees observed them constantly. I would also...
No appeal from the denial of the mistrial.
That's correct. Yes, ma'am. I would also like, and I promise the court I'll try to minimize the amount of reading I do, but there is a case I'd like to cite that was not cited in our brief with regard to the amount of deference that ought to be owed to the judge, Judge Voorhees.
Summarize it. Just summarize.
Yes, sir. The case is a Supreme Court case from 1978, Arizona v. Washington. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that the judge himself has observed the apparent reactions of the jurors. He is more conversant with the factors relevant to the determination than any reviewing court can be. And I'd submit under those.
And the truth is that any competent judge, Judge Voorhees certainly is, sit there, and even if somebody nodded, if he took their body language to cause some concern, he would either take some action to strike that juror or to take some further inquiry or bench or sidebar, something to deal with. We presume that and know that to be true unless somebody pointed the record that it's not true. But he sits there and he observes, and quite frankly, he has no great interest in keeping a juror on that panel when that juror may taint the process. And because for no other reason, he's going to be retrying that case again later. So there's no incentive whatsoever for him to do anything other than what is right and proper for a fair trial.
Yes,
is there?
No, sir. In fact, to the contrary, it'd be a waste of everybody's time, most importantly, the judge who already has a backup calendar. Your Honor, one last thing, if I could, going to the merits and the test that I did not hear raised previously on this issue from the other side, we'd submit
that. Let me just note, too, along that line, I would just add this. I have been involved with jurors before. When they told me in response to a question they could be fair and impartial, but I still struck them and explained to the lawyers based on quivering lips and they would not look in the eye and all that, that I just didn't think they could, even though they said they could. I struck them because I didn't think under the circumstances I was concerned about their body language, although I'd used the word fair and impartial. Can you be fair? Can you put that aside? My observation, based on the case that you said, it was my experience that sometimes you'd have to go beyond those actual words by looking at total body language, appearance, reaction, and all of that, how they respond to the question. That is what that Arizona case recognized.
Yes, sir. And in fact, it's the same principle by which, as this court knows, fact-finding is owed such great deference because it's not the dry transcript, it's the demeanor, it's the body language, be it whether it's a jury determination or a bench determination. Your Honor, the test under the Rimmer analysis, the test, though, about whether there's a reasonable possibility that the verdict was tainted, and that's what it comes down to. Is there a reasonable possibility? And this court has recognized, by the way, in an en banc decision, the Sherman v. Smith decision, which we cite, 1996, en banc, that there is ultimately a harmlessness review for these kinds of issues. And in U.S. v. Basham, decided just 2 years ago, that was a capital case tried out of South Carolina, that the court is to examine the entire picture, including the factual circumstances and the impact on the juror, and the court imposed a five-part test. One, the extent of improper communications. Here, they were brief. There was one isolated comment to Juror J, and then the little Kenny, which was also brief in a public place. Two, the extent the communication was discussed or considered by the jury. It happened at lunchtime. As soon as lunch was over, Judge Voorhees is doing the voir dire in chambers, and he's telling the jurors, and under Alano, we have to assume they followed his instructions, he's telling the jurors, don't talk about this anymore. So there was a very little time, as opposed to Cheek, where the guy brooded over the attempt of bribery by a co-defendant, and only it came out only later, and he admitted he was scared and was afraid of retaliation. That was Cheek. Number three under Basham, the type of information communicated. Here there was no factual information. It was a threat-type information. And as Chief Justice Traxler pointed out, I can't find any case that says, well, if anything, it kind of helps the defendant, so we're not submitting that. But again, it was brief, and only Jolly was explicitly threatened. The timing of the exposure, it was early in the case, unlike some of the other cases that we cite in our brief, where the timing is, for example, in Stockton, the Commonwealth, it's a death penalty case where the timing of the improper comments, which was the cafe owner saying they ought to fry that SOB, is during the penalty phase, the death penalty phase of the trial. Here, it came early on. The judge, unlike in Cheek and unlike in Rimmer, the trial judge was alerted, did some prophylactic measures, and had an opportunity to observe the demeanor of the jurors for the rest of the trial. And finally, the fifth element under Basham, and this is our strongest, is the strength of the government's case, which, as Judge Voorhees found in his February 5th, 2009 order, quote, overwhelming evidence of the defendant's, plural, guilt. So with regard to those, Your Honor, we would submit that Cheek and Rimmer are distinguishable on those facts, and under the harmlessness review, that the court did not err. If I may, I'd like to move on to the juror M, the male juror issue. With regard to that issue, Your Honor, I'd like to point out a couple, again, of minor factual corrections. As the court knows, Mr. M, by the time he testified, it was 1 year and 11 months after the trial. Trial is January of 07. He's testifying in December of 09. I'm sorry, December of 08, I believe it was. But anyway, it was just short of 2 years. He was a little confused, but Judge Voorhees found that he was credible. The McDonough test puts the burden on the defense to show that he failed to answer the material question honestly, and an incorrect answer is enough, and we've conceded that was enough. The first prong satisfied. That a correct response would have provided a valid basis for a for-cause challenge, which I want to discuss. But finally, this court has held in Conaway v. Pope, 2006, that the defendant must show that the fairness of his trial was affected either by the juror's motives for concealing the information or the reasons that affect his impartiality. Now, first of all, to correct the facts a little, although Mr. M was a little confused at some points, it appears. He said, he didn't say he knew the defendants were dealing drugs. He did say that at one point that he had heard they dealt with drugs, which obviously could mean using or selling. To the extent there's any concern about his having seen the jurors, the defendants laughing because they thought they were going to get off, well, if that happened during the trial, that's their own fault, because the jury, obviously, since these men were being held, could only have seen them when they were in the courtroom. Now, if they're laughing in the courtroom, that's on them. But with regard to a question Judge Shedd asked, and what I think we need to get into, is this. What does it mean for cause, a strike for cause? The defense would argue, well, as long as we've got a good faith basis to make it, that's enough. Unfortunately, that's not what for them. That's not what the court holds. In McNeil v. Polk and in Folks, I want to enunciate clearly, Folks, there is a per se rule of disqualification. That is, would it have been reversible error had the court refused to strike? And I cite the court briefly to some of the cases that we've cited in our brief where this court has found that it was not per se error. For example, when in Folks, a capital murder case out of South Carolina, it was the co-defendant of Basham, actually, in Folks, the juror neglected to answer in a capital murder case that her husband had been murdered. And the court said that that wouldn't have been a per se reason to strike.
This case, you can see to this point, I don't think it's fatal to your argument. I'm just wondering, after looking at this, after looking at the facts for this juror, if maybe there's a distinction between know and know of that we don't really acknowledge. And I've seen people say these days, do you know Mr. Smith? And they go, no, I don't know him. And I said, well, I thought that you had a lot of associates. And somebody else said, well, I know of him, but I don't know him. In other words, I don't know him to call him a friend. And I just kind of wondered if this didn't call, I don't think it's critical to anything in this case. But when the gentleman said he didn't know him, he answered it, voir dire, I don't know him. I guess he just asked, did anybody know? I don't remember exactly how the phrase. And then he later explained, well, I know of him, and I know who he is, but I don't really know him. Isn't that what he said?
Yes, sir. And in fact,
you just sort of conceded past that point, I think.
Well, because it's in our pleading, so I don't want to backtrack. But, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I know who my congressman is. I'd recognize him if I saw him. But I don't know him in the sense of being able, I wouldn't feel comfortable calling him by name.
Probably
if he that's right. Well, especially every November, he speaks very highly of me. But yes, so, and that one issue, Your Honor, does go to the bias issue, because it's the opinions of health. We can impute bias much more readily if there's a reason to think the person lied. But as the court has held in, I forget the case, Your Honor, but as the court held, there was a situation where a juror who had been a reporter and had covered the first trial, was asked, did she have firsthand knowledge? Well, heck, she had talked to the prosecutors, the investigators, but this court found she wasn't lying because she took firsthand to mean she personally hadn't done it. Things of that nature. So, no, there's nothing to indicate Mr. M was trying to lie. There's nothing to indicate he wanted to be on this jury, as there was in the Conaway case where the guy in a swearing contest really wanted to vindicate his co-defendant, and he really wanted to hurt the defendant.
I got you off track. Anything else you want to add to your argument?
The only other things I'd like to add, Your Honor, because Your Honor asked this question, on page 1413 of the record, what Judge Voorhees said with regard to whether he the for cause, he said he likely would have excused juror so-and-so for cause in an abundance of caution, but that the defendants failed to establish an implied bias existed that would have required the court to excuse him for cause, would have required the court, and he highlighted required. And that's the point we're making. In an abundance of caution, if I've got a juror who says, I'm having surgery a week from now, I'm worried about whether this trial might go on, I'm not sure I could concentrate, I would certainly agree. Let's excuse that juror for cause. If the judge, because the panel of the veneer is dwindling, says, no, we'll keep her on, I'm going to hold your feet to the fire to move fast. Is that reversible error? Of course not. There's all kinds of things, especially, as Your Honor acknowledged, when we're going to have a lengthy trial with a life sentence at stake for one defendant, in particular, there's all kinds of things prophylactically we might have granted, but the court is speaking basically in the subjunctive, likely would have if known. But that is not the test this court has.
All right. Before you run out of time, I'm going to ask you
a
question unrelated to the argument you've been making, just out of my personal curiosity. With regard to the organizational chart that was sent back to the jury at their request.
Yes, sir.
When I read the transcript, it was admitted into evidence. I'm just curious why it didn't go back to the jury along with all of the other items in there.
I can tell Your Honor this as a general matter. I did not search that. But I know generally from my experience as a trial attorney with Judge Voorhees as well as the other judges in the Western District, they don't send anything back at first. They always wait for the jury to ask.
For the evidence?
Yes, sir. Now, I cannot give you a jury cite to say that happened here. This is habit of testimony.
Now, are organizational charts like this used frequently in courts in your experience?
Your Honor, that I cannot say because I have not been a drug prosecutor since I moved down here from the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office. I know we use them a lot in D.C., but I have been a white-collar prosecutor and haven't tried to use them. I hate to be wrong. The last point I'd like to make, Your Honor, Rose v. Lee on the 60B evidence, the court did find that Juror M. I'm out of time. May I make one last point? Thank you. The court did find that Juror M. Testified that this would have had no effect on his opinion, on his decision-making, et cetera, which would appear to be incompetent under 606B. I recognize that. However, one, the defense opened the door by creating this evidence and asking it to begin with. But secondly, not only in Parker v. Gladden, the Supreme Court case, did the court specifically rely on the juror testimony about he's a wicked man and he's guilty, that affected her. But this court in Rose v. Lee, which unfortunately we did not cite, 252 Fed 3rd 676, footnote 12, says that 606B objections, just like any other objections, can be waived. And the defense here did not object under 606B to Mr. M's testimony.
Thank
you very much.
Ms. Richardson,
I apologize for running over.
Ms. Richardson, you have reply, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm just going to kind of pick up with the Juror M claim. I'm glad to see that the government did acknowledge that, in fact, the district court found I would have excused him for cause. And that's why we've met the McDonough test. It's undisputed that he failed to honestly answer the question and that the correct response would provide a valid basis for challenge for cause. The district court's already told you, in observing him, I would have excused him. So we would say we've already met McDonough. There's not what the error in the district court did here was to somehow extrapolate from other cases that the language correct response would provide a valid basis for challenge for cause means I would abuse my discretion if I didn't excuse him. And there's no case law that says that. The language doesn't say it. There's no case law that interprets that second prong in that way. And in fact, this court in United States versus Turner made it very clear that this court does not want to create a lot of per se disqualification rules because you want to leave it up to the district court to excuse jurors for cause because they're the ones who can see the situation and observe the juror and that kind of thing. So I think that there is just simply no support in the case law for the idea that somehow abuse of discretion or actual bias had to be proved at that point. I think this is a very easy thing for this court. This McDonough has already been shown in the record. We've already prevailed on that claim. Going back to the claim of the threats and intimidation claim, the government talks about the strength of the government's case. And when you're talking about
you have to surmount the timeliness issue first.
The timeliness issue. You're talking about as to the new trial motion?
Whether the evidence was newly discovered.
Well, let me go back. It is incorrect to say that we are not challenging the motion, the denial of the motion for mistrial. Making the motion for mistrial at trial preserves the issue for review.
No, I had asked if you had appealed the denial of the mistrial.
Yes, we've appealed both. And our position is the government's taking the position that there's nothing new about this, that all of that was known. And our position is, if you knew that Juror Jolly was upset all the way through, that she was crying all the way through, scared for her children and all of that, if all of that is known, then he made the error at trial. If that is new evidence, he made the error in denying the motion for new trial. I think you can't have, the government cannot have that point both ways. And to talk about, you all, to go back to the harmlessness issue, the strength of the government's case only matters when you're talking about what, if the contact has to do with information that the other, that the juror would not have had as evidence in the case. So what you're saying is it cumulative of something else? You can't just say there was a lot of evidence, so it doesn't matter if the jurors were impartial. That's like saying only innocent people get impartial juries. The point is the strength of the government's case is completely irrelevant here because the contact had nothing to do with evidence presented. So the issue of whether it was cumulative or somehow did not have an impact is irrelevant because it's not on that issue. And I see I'm out of time if you have any further questions. Thank you.